pandemic got us into a reflective space and made us look inward to see what we can do for the world at large. As a self-expression coach, I became a catalyst for women and started Vani, a one-on-one coaching program for women on finding their voice, to speak up, to be visible. As a storyteller, I spotted there were many ordinary people amongst us leading extraordinary lives, making a difference to the world, and they needed to be heard. Thus was born You and I with Rashmi Shetty, where amazing personal journeys with their uniqueness and individuality are showcased. A reaffirmation of the fact, open your eyes wider, the world is far more beautiful when we acknowledge the presence of both you and I. Our guest today is Andrea Sampson. As the CEO and founder of Talk Boutique, she provides her expertise as an executive coach to senior leaders and professional speakers worldwide. Having spent the first 20 plus years of her career as a senior leader in marketing and advertising, Andrea regularly gave talks and presentations that deeply connected and impacted her audiences. Using these skills combined with her experience on TED events and her training as a TED speakers coach, Andrea helps her clients make their work accessible while maintaining credibility and uniqueness. She has a special skill in understanding technical and science-based disciplines using storytelling as a connection tool. As part of the team to bring Singularity University to Canada, Andrea has worked with and trained Singularity University faculty worldwide. She also holds a TEDx license and has participated in the Global TED Initiative Countdown 2020. Listen in as Andrea shares her journey, her influences, and what shaped her to be who she is today. Hi, Andrea. Such a pleasure having you on You and I with Rashmi Shetty.
Thank you, Rashmi.
You are somebody that I've followed on LinkedIn, and I love your posts, especially the way you connect those beautiful videos to the message that you sent across. That got me curious to find out who is Andrea, and I love the work that you do, Andrea. But before we get there, what was little Andrea like to the Andrea that the world knows you today as?
Well, my mother used to describe me as being, she used to say, oh, you have such a hard head, is how she would say it. And what she meant was I was very stubborn. I was a child with my own mind, curious all the time, getting into way more than I should. And always wanting to be creative. I loved to create. I loved to color. I could remember when I was very young, we lived in an apartment building. And I remember that there were workers outside who at one point were working on the telephone wires, you know, sort of overhead. And in those days, of course, they weren't very tidy. And so they had dropped big chunks of wire. And if you know anything about that kind of wire, if you peel back the colorful casings, there's all kinds of more colorful casings inside. Mm-hmm. And I remember being just so amazed by this and decided that I was going to be a jewelry designer using wire that people threw away. And so I started creating all of these little pieces of jewelry that I set up. Instead of a lemonade stand, I set up a jewelry stand. So that kind of tells you a little bit about me.
No, but really, that creativity, that innovation, how long did it stay with you? Where did it lead you? And how did you grow up? What were the subjects that interested you as you kept growing? Because the curiosity element definitely was there. And you found an outlet to it that is so interesting. Do you still make jewelry with wires?
You know what I do? I actually do. Now I make real jewelry. I don't do it as often as I would like, but I do. I have a full jewelry making kit and you know, credit, set up a mobile studio whenever I can, and I sit down with wow. silver wire now, and usually with some form of gemstone, and I work with it. I find it incredibly relaxing, and I mean, you might be able to tell I do love color. And so it's one of the things that really, really inspires me. So if we go back to little Andrea and what was I like in those days and, you know, where did that curiosity lead me? I mean, I was never a great student or a bad student. I was also one of those sort of middle of the road. And, you know, I think what my teachers used to always say about me is, oh, Andrea has so much potential, but she talks too much. And I never, you know, I always used to think to myself, well, it's not me talking, it's the other people. They talk to me and then I have to talk back, right? You can't be rude. But the potential piece used to always baffle me. And I think if I look back now, you know, what I've come to learn about myself, didn't know then, because of course, when you're young, you don't understand these things, was that my creative, curious mind was very fast. And what would happen is I would get bored very quickly. And so the work that we were doing in the classroom, I was often far beyond everyone else. So I'd stop paying attention. And then of course I would fall behind because I wasn't paying attention. And so it was always this sort of back and forth of thinking I knew it all and then realizing I had missed the train of thought and it would have to go back.
Well, you know, as I grew up, I continued to be very curious. Curious, stubborn, as my mother would say, always had my own ideas, wanted to do things my own way. And, you know, as I became a teenager, I started to explore things in a new way. And what became clear for me as I was going through school was that it really wasn't for me. What I didn't know then, but do know now, is that I had a neurodiversity. I've recently been diagnosed with ADD, which is a disorder. Well, in fact, there's many that would say it's a superpower, and most entrepreneurs are ADD. But the way it manifests is that it means that it's difficult to regulate attention. You're either hyper-focused or not focused at all. And that certainly described me as a teenager. And I decided that I wanted to leave school or leave the sort of traditional school. It wasn't serving me, at least in my 16-year-old brain. And I made the decision that I was going to go to a community college. And I found a way to get into a community college without a high school diploma, because I was only in the first year of high school at that point. And so I dropped out of high school and I got myself into a community college and I took a secretarial diploma. And because I was an overachiever, even in those days, I made the decision that I wasn't just going to be a secretary. I wanted to be the best secretary I could be. And so I started taking night classes at a continuing ed school in legal secretarial studies. And so when I graduated from that 2-year secretarial program, as all of my peers were graduating from high school, I graduated at the top of my class as a secretary and also with qualifications to become a legal secretary. So there I was at 18, ready to enter the workforce, supporting lawyers in all of what it is that lawyers do. And of course, I wasn't really ready.
What is it that intrigued you about law, Andrea? How did you know at 18 that law would be a beautiful space to explore? Who introduced there? What did you read? How did you get in there? Again, the curious you?
Yeah, you know, so like I said, there was so much I didn't know about myself in those days, but I look back and I realize now what it was. But what in those days, I mean, you know, TV, I think there were many legal programs on TV, which had intrigued me. And I thought, oh, to be a lawyer, it seemed so glorious, you know, and so glamorous. And I, but I didn't have the, I was like, but I can't spend 6 years in school and all that money to pay for it. I just couldn't imagine it. And so, well, I thought, well, maybe I could do that later, but maybe what I could do now is learn about it by being a legal secretary. And so that was what it was. It was sort of a little bit of me being curious and saying, well, I don't want to jump in with both feet, but what I do want to do is get an exposure to it. And so I spent the next couple of years working for, you know, lawyers and understanding their work. And quite frankly, I was a terrible secretary. You know, it was never what I was supposed to be. I was way more interested in reading all of the dockets than I was in doing the work. I would get these files from the lawyers because, of course, I was 18. I was, you know, the lowest of the low in the office. And so my job was to type up contracts and things like that. And, you know, the law firm that I was working for had a number of lawyers. And so I sort of sat in a shared pool where the lawyers could just use a group of us. And so we would get handed these file folders full of legal documents, and on top would be a little cassette recorder that we would have to put into a recording device and listen to it on headphones and type what the lawyer was saying. But I would get really engrossed in the actual, I would open the folder and I would start going through the legal documents of what is this? Because I was so curious about everything. And I would read them and I was fascinated by it. And of course, you know, I would be very slow in typing the letters or doing the work that they needed to do because I had to read everything. So it wasn't a career for me. But you know, what happened for me was that I spent a couple of years working as a secretary. I left, even though I had become a legal secretary, I left that and went and ended up working for the federal government here in Canada, and ended up sort of at 21 being at the top of my field as a secretary. I had achieved within the government their top classification. Everything is class, you know, it's all of these levels that you must go through. And here I was, 21 years old, you know, making more money than any of my friends, who were all still in school, by the way. And I was working for, you know, political ministers as their secretary. And I was bored. I was bored silly. And I knew that this was not long-term for me. The secretarial world was not something I was going to stay in. So I started looking around thinking, well, where from here? And I had this idea, well, what if I went back to school? Now, let's go back in time and remember, I don't have a high school diploma. I might have a college diploma, but I don't have a high school diploma. And so I made the decision I was going to go to university. And of course, you need to have a high school diploma. Well, I found that I could, I found a loophole. This was always what I did. I could find loopholes in everything. And so I found a loophole that said that I could go to a university as a mature student if I had been out of school, out of second, like out of high school for more than 3 years. Well, of course I had been, because I had spent 2 years taking a secretarial diploma at this community college, which didn't count as being in school. So I found this loophole and I was able to go back to university and take, and I made the decision that what I really wanted to do was to be a public relations person. This seemed, again, glamorous to me, you know. Oh, and I think it probably was another TV program I was watching about PR. And so I thought it looked so amazing. You know, you were, spent your days working with clients on big launches and events, and it seemed like so much fun. So I found the only university in Canada at that time that was offering a full degree in public relations, and applied and got in as a mature student. And that university had only just transitioned from a Catholic university that was all female. Probably within 5 years, they had just transformed into more of a public university that was co-ed. But of course, it was still very female dominated, and the nuns were still many of the professors. Well, you know, as you know, you look at me, even today, I don't look like the traditional Catholic girl, let's just say, that would go to a Catholic university, even though, again, it wasn't at the time Catholic, but still the nuns. So I was very, very much a nonconformist. And I lasted about a year in that university and realized that was not for me. So I transferred to another university and transferred my degree into a marketing degree. And did that. And while I was going to university, I was bartending at night and I was waitressing in between classes to put myself through university because, of course, I had moved out on my own. I did that when I was 18. As soon as I graduated from my secretarial program, I moved out. And so there I was, you know, working, going to school, you know, learning lots. But I was 21 and maybe a little more mature, not a whole lot more mature than my classmates, but kind of really starting my life as a quasi-adult. And a friend of mine at that time, who I'd known through childhood, not a really close friend, but a friend, had made the decision to move away. And, you know, when it's, I think there are these points in our lives where we're sort of shown maybe a different path. And that was one of them for me. It was the first of my friends who had really decided to sort of make a big move out of our small little community that I was living in. I remember thinking, wow, you know, that's really brave. And, you know, what will you do? And I remember, you know, sort of our going away dinner, like I think a bunch of us got together to send her off. And I was curious, like why, you know, and she was going because her then boyfriend, now husband, had moved there to become, had moved away to become a police officer in Toronto, actually, in this large city in Toronto, in Canada. And I was very curious and I was like, well, what will you do? And she was at the time, I think had just finished university and she said, you know, well, I'll probably go back to university and I don't know. But it got me to thinking and, you know, I started looking at my own life and saying, and, you know, asking the question of, well, why am I here? Why am I here in this small community? I'm going to school, I'm bartending. There's nothing keeping me here. I mean, my family was there and clearly that is a tie, but at the same time, I was ambitious. And Nova Scotia, I lived in, at the time, a suburb of Halifax, which is the largest city in Nova Scotia. And it is a government city and a tourism city or its natural resources. And so if you're not working in one of those three areas, you really can't get a job. And for a woman, it was even harder. It's small. I mean, at the time, I think in the entire province, there were under 1 million people in the province. And so, you know, it had very traditional views. And often what was happening is that, you know, women were seen to be teachers or secretaries or, you know, sort of childcare and anything more than that was kind of reserved for men because they had to support families. And so as I started thinking about, well, what do I want? And I knew I wanted a career. And I thought, well, I could do that anywhere. I could do what I'm doing here anywhere. And maybe that would be a better way for me to start a career. So I started looking around and Canada is very large. And so, you know, there's a lot of different places I could go to. And so I was living on the east coast of Canada, 15 minutes from the ocean. And the ocean was a big part of my life. So I thought, well, maybe I'll go to the west coast of Canada, to Vancouver and go to the Pacific Ocean. And so, and then I thought, well, my friend had just moved to Toronto. So I knew one person in Toronto. So I thought, well, maybe I'll go to Toronto. And so I decided to apply to a couple of universities thinking, well, okay, cause I'm in university. Well, let me see who'll take me. I'm a mature student, you know, have kind of a checkered past. Let's see who wants me. And I applied to three or four universities and all really high-end top universities. And surprise of all surprises for me was I got into all of them. And that really wasn't helpful because now I thought the choice would be made for me by who would accept me. Well, no, they all wanted me. So then I was like, okay, well, now I actually do have to choose. So I started looking at the West Coast and, you know, to get from where I was in Nova Scotia all the way to British Columbia, which is the West Coast, it's about a 6-hour plane ride, and it's a 3-hour time difference. And that seemed like a lot for the very first time moving out of Nova Scotia. And so I made the decision that I was going to kind of split the difference, because Toronto is right in the middle of the country. It's only a 2-hour plane ride and a 1-hour time difference. And I thought, well, you know what, if this doesn't work out, I can always go home. It feels like it felt closer. I got homesick. It didn't seem that far away. So that's what I did. I packed up everything I owned. And I literally sold my car. I mean, that was one of the things that happened for me that was in my teens. That was actually quite an interesting turn of events, is I won a car when I was 18, just as I was graduating. I won a car, yes.
Was it a lottery or something?
It was a draw, you know, you fill out a ticket and you put a draw in, and I won a car, and I won a convertible. It was a convertible Volkswagen. And so I had this cute little car, which, you know, had served me well, which I didn't owe anything on, and ended up selling everything I owned as I made the decision to move to Toronto and packed up my...
One pause now, Andrea.
Yeah, sure.
Because... you've seen so much at 21, and today you can always go on Google, and Google will give you ideas, what is best for you and for your interest. And at that time, who was your mentor? How did you take these important life-turning decisions, or did you even see them as life-changing decisions? How did you take those decisions? Just because the ocean is here, the time difference is here, this is going to be in the center, and it's just 1 hour time difference, so I'm going to move there. What is it that helped you take those important decisions? Because I'm sure now, looking back, each of those moves shaped you to who you are today. Were you a very confident person at that time? Super confident, in fact, that you could take all these decisions?
I was stubborn. I was really headstrong. And, you know, I when you say who was my mentor, I didn't have one. You know, I came from a family that was very fractured. You know, my parents had a very difficult marriage, which, you know, meant there was abuse and things. And so I knew from a very young age that I was going to need to take care of myself, that there was no one was going to take care of me. And, you know, I have 4 siblings, so there's 5 of us in total. And I had the, you know, I'm the second youngest. And so I had seen my 3 siblings all make different decisions. My oldest sister got married very young. My second sister had kids young, but kind of went maybe a little bit more independent and eventually got married. But I saw her settling for a life because she wanted to be taken care of. And then my brother, my older brother, was sort of dabbling in a lot of different things. And so I had these different views of the world through my siblings, I guess. And I knew that none of their choices were right for me. What I knew about myself, I think, is that I had drive. I was driven to succeed. I was driven to be more than what anyone thought I could be. In those days, people used to tell me a lot that I would never amount to anything. And that was a message I got a lot from my father. And I knew he was wrong. And in those early days, I was not ever going to let anyone be right about me not being able to make anything of my life. And I also knew that I wasn't going to rely on a marriage or a man or a partner, because that was too risky. I was going to take care of myself. And so as I would make these decisions, you know, when I look back now, it's like, you're right. There was no Google. Like it wasn't like I could look it up and go, well, this is a good decision. And I certainly didn't have, you know, a therapist or even a counselor who I was talking to. I did a lot of thinking. I did a lot of reading. I was a reader. And so I read books upon books, and I remember discovering around that time self-help books. And that was really the beginning of the self-help era. And I started reading a couple of books that really talked about, you know, sort of the idea of vision it and it will come, like kind of that idea. And I remember, I think one of the first books that I had really connected with was in those days was the Celestine Prophecy, which, you know, I think still is around. I don't even know, but I remember reading it and not really fully getting it, but just thinking, wow, you know, that you don't have to live the life that people expect you to live. You can live a life that you want. And that was a radical idea for me. And I made the decision that that's exactly what I was going to do with my life, that I was going to be a success, that I was going to not take a traditional path, that my decisions were always based on what people were able to achieve when they had everything. But I was going to achieve it because I had nothing, you know, and I remember in those days having a mantra, which was successful people don't succeed because a lack of obstacles, they succeed in spite of them. And that was me. It was like throw an obstacle in my past. I will show you how I can not only get over it, but turn it into an opportunity for myself. And that's what I did.
So what did the 20 plus you now do once you moved?
So, well, I moved to Toronto. So what I made the decision of was to go to Toronto. And I remember, so I packed up my car. I found a buyer in Ottawa, which is about 5 hours from Toronto. So the drive from Halifax to Toronto in those days was about 20 hours. And so I pack up my convertible, and I had met this man I was bartending in Halifax, and I had met this man at the bar who heard me saying I was selling my car. And he said, well, I'll buy it. But here's the condition. You have to drive it to Ottawa, which was about 16 hours away. And I was planning I didn't know how I was going to get to Toronto, quite frankly. I had made the decision to move to Toronto, didn't know how I was going to get there. And so it was great. I can drive my car and I'll get to Ottawa, and then I'll figure out how to get to Toronto from Ottawa. That was my plan. Not a very good plan, but that was my plan. So I sold everything I owned at the time, packed up my clothes and a few other items, one of which, kind of funny, I always think about this. So, I pack up my little car and I can still see it. It was packed to the rafters with all of that. And this was in 1989. And microwaves had just come out. And I remember that for me, I had gotten a microwave, and this was like a sign that I had made it because I had a microwave. And so I took, the only thing I kept was my microwave and my clothes, and I drove it to Toronto. I don't even own a microwave today, you know, but in those days, for whatever reason, that was a symbol for me. So there I did. So there I arrived I sell my car. I promised to sell my car in Ottawa. I didn't even really sell it. So the guy said, drive it to Ottawa, come to my dealership. He owned a dealership, and he had given me a post-dated check for 1 week. I had a week to get there. And he said, if you don't show up, I will cancel the check. So blind trust, I get in my car, I drive to Ottawa, show up. The guy was surprised I showed up, but he honored the deal. And not only did he honor the deal, he ended up driving me to Toronto. And, you know, I arrived in Toronto, and I think if there's moments in our lives that are predestined, that would be one of them. You know, I truly do believe that we are all so, we're guided in ways we don't know, and we are protected in ways that we don't know. And so when I arrived in Toronto, here I was at the time 23. I didn't have a place to live. I didn't have a job. I had an acceptance into a university, and Toronto at the time was in the midst of one of the largest housing crisis of its time. There was nowhere to live in Toronto. And literally people were paying landlords money just to get them, you know, in to be able to see apartments. And so this is what I arrive into. And I had my one friend who had moved here who said, hey, you can crash on my couch for a couple of days while you find a place to live. And I literally arrived, and within a day, I had a job. I had a place to live in a rent-controlled apartment. And I had the university ready to start in a month. It was as if there was a divine intervention of making sure that I knew I was in the right place at the right time. And I never looked back. You know, Toronto is a very large city. I can remember being so lost for the first, I would say, 2 years. You know, I had never experienced a subway. Nova Scotia doesn't have subways. And so I remember first of all, being amazed that there were these things called subways, and then coming up out of the subway, you know, the subterranean world, and looking around of where am I? And everyone was speaking in, you know, directions of north, south, east, and west. And I'm like, is that left or is that right? I have no idea. And, you know, so for the first couple of years, I was pretty lost in Toronto, but I loved it. You know, there was something really that spoke to the drive in me. I think as I look back now, I see that I never fit where I grew up. I was so different from everybody, my family, the people who were around me, because I was so certain. And I wasn't certain from a place of self-confidence, because I wouldn't say that I was a self-confident person. I was just driven. And I often, I think internally questioned my own decisions. No, I didn't question my decisions. I questioned myself and my worth, but I didn't question my decisions. I followed my own intuition. And when I made a decision, it was a decision. I wasn't going back on it. I was going to move forward, and I was going to make it the best decision I could make. So always, I always had the sense, I guess, and again, now I don't know where I got it, but it was there, that if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it at the best possible level that I can do something. And so, you know, I didn't just go to community college. I went to community college and did night school. You know, I didn't just go to university. I was going to do university and have something that was very unique. For me, it was always about showing up different than everyone else, because that seemed to be the way in which I needed to show up in the world. I wasn't like anyone else. I didn't want to be like anyone else. I didn't want to be compared to anyone else. And it was one of the things that really annoyed me as a child, was that I was always someone's little sister. And, you know, my three siblings who are older than me, you know, were known within our community. And so I didn't want that. I was like, no, I'm my own person, and I'm not like them, and I won't be compared to them. And so, that was important for me.
Oh, this is such a beautiful journey, Andrea, from that curious little girl to this person who was so driven and sure. And I love it when you say, I was not self-confident, but I was driven that I needed to create an identity which is my own. And so what is it about Toronto that altered in you, or did it alter you at all? Did it teach you a lot more than you had bargained for? How did life open out for you in Toronto?
Yeah, it has been a lifelong journey. I mean, I've been in Toronto now, 33 years. I've lived in Toronto longer than I lived in Nova Scotia. And when I, in those first few years, you know, I came here because I wanted to remove what I viewed as being the constrictions that were holding me back. And I think what I also believed about myself in those early days was that I was creative, and that I couldn't be creative in Nova Scotia for whatever reason. And I thought that I could be that creative soul in Toronto. But I got here with such, you know, haste and confusion, right? Like I arrive here and everything was sort of given to me in some ways, and which, you know, was like, okay. I mean, my original plan was I was just going to get a job in a bar, and I ended up actually being hired by a recruiter and thrown into the corporate world. And I that creativity got put on the back burner. And I was so disoriented. Like the city was so large. I mean, you know, Toronto is large just in area. You know, it's to go from one end of what's called the Greater Toronto area, from one end to the other on a highway, it's almost a 2-hour drive. So it's quite large. And, you know, that's in comparison to where I was, where Nova Scotia is this like Halifax, tiny little city, tiny, tiny little city. And so, you know, you would meet people, like just making friends was a challenge because I meet people, you know, in my job, but I would live at one end of the city and they would live at the other. Well, you can't be friends, you know? I mean, you can be friends at work, but, you know, and like even going out after work, there was all of these challenges that were new for me. Everything was new. And it took me a while to really find my feet. And I found myself, you know, sort of by circumstance ending up working in the not-for-profit world. And again, typical me, I ended up changing my studies again, because when I got here, it was like, there was no way I was going to be able to turn it around and go to university. And so I started doing night classes, working during the day, and those night classes started to evolve. And what I ended up doing was going into the not-for-profit sector and specializing in fundraising and getting a diploma and a certificate in fundraising management and eventually going on to become a certified fundraiser. And it was a world that really spoke to me because it was a world of passion. What happens, of course, the people who you work with and interact with, they do what they do because they're trying to make change. They're trying to create, they're trying to support something. And it felt right to me. It felt like, yes, if I'm going to spend 8, 10, 12 hours a day doing something, I want it to have meaning. And so I knew that I was giving up salary for, you know, for passion, because the not-for-profit sector is not famous for paying very well. But, you know, I felt good about what I was doing. And I worked for a number of small charities and not-for-profits and helping them to grow. And I learned and grew with them. And what I loved about working in the not-for-profit sector was that I got to be all of me. I remember around that time, I started reading business books and starting to understand, like, what do I want to be? What do I want to do? And I remember coming across this idea of specializing, of being a specialist in something. And many of the books that I was reading kept saying, you should specialize. That's how you'll get ahead. And I remember thinking, oh my God, that sounds horrible. Why would I want to do that? And as I read more and, you know, more gurus out there, I remember finding one, I don't even remember who it was, I talked about being a generalist. And I was like, that's what I want to be. I want to be a generalist. I want to do everything. And I want to have enough knowledge. And that seemed to me like, it was like, because I kept thinking to myself, how would I ever get ahead in business? And, you know, if I'm going to get ahead, if I am a specialist, then I'm only going to go to the head of that specialty. But if I'm a generalist, I could be the head of a company. And so that seemed like the better option for me. So that's what I did. So in the not-for-profit world, that was really good because they never have enough people. And there's always more jobs than there are people to do them. And so I did everything. I may have been a fundraiser, but I was also the IT person, because in those days, computers were just becoming something. And so, you know, I started off with, you know, being the only person in the office that had a computer on my desk. And then I had to learn how to program that computer. And then I had to learn how to use databases because would raise money. We had, but we didn't call them databases. We called them donor bases. And then I learned how to actually connect the computer so that my computer could talk to somebody else's computer. Because in those days, we didn't have the internet. So you literally had to physically wire the computers together in what was called a network. And so I learned how to do that. So I was the fundraiser. I was the IT person, but I was also the public relations person. I also did marketing, you know, and probably various and sundry other jobs along the way. And so my time in the not-for-profit world served me because it let me grow in ways that I didn't even know I was growing, but I loved it. And I worked like crazy hours, you know, because half the time with the companies I worked with or the organizations that I worked with, my boss and my bosses were the volunteers. They were, you know, the volunteer board of directors. So they met, you know, between 5 and 10 at night. And so I would work all day and then have to go to the meetings at night and manage those meetings because, you know, these were, I was the staff person. So it was my job to make sure that the meetings were well managed and that the volunteers had what they needed and that we were driving forward on the goals of the organization. So I would often work these crazy long hours, which of course I wasn't paid for, but I didn't care. You know, I loved what I was doing. And I eventually specialized in doing very large scale gala events where we would run these incredible events, raise a lot of money and have fun. And it fed in me this need to create. I learned through that work that I was a builder. I loved building things from, you know, the conception of the idea all the way through to the execution of it and all the bits and pieces in between. And I was really good at it. But I got bored really quick. You know, this again, I look back and this is the neurodiverse brain, right? This is where it was like, I would learn something. I'd learn it fully. I would become the best in that. I would be in demand. And then I go, yeah, I've done that. I don't need to do it anymore. And move on. And I did this so many times in my career. But that, you know, that was a beautiful time in my career because I was learning so much.
Andrea, all along in your story, one thing is very clear. Everything that you have done has always helped you in your next step, whether you knew it or not. Yes. Like they say, life is what happens while we are busy planning. You are not even planning. And it was just happening. It was just happening. Everything seemed to just lead you correctly in a frame and into a frame that was ready to accept you. So now what happened after the nonprofit? What was waiting for you on the other side when you got born?
So, you know, that was another interesting journey. And like you said, I didn't know what I was leading up to. You know, when I was in the not-for-profit world, I thought that I wanted to stay in that world and become, you know, the executive director of a charity and do that. And what became clear for me was that as you got more senior in the not-for-profit world, what happened was you would, it really just became more and more about the politics of the organization and the politics of managing volunteers. And I didn't want that. And so it was hard to leave though, because in those days, and this would have been in the mid 90s now, charities and not-for-profits were still seen as being just volunteer work, even though I was a paid staff. And so when I went out into trying to shift, I had a lot of people going, well, you've never worked. You've only done volunteer work. And I was like, well, no, that was a lot of work. And so I had to make a couple of jumps. And so I jumped into the service industry. I was working in a contract call center as an account manager, the largest contract call center in Canada, working on some of the largest brands at the time in telcos and energy. And I was doing a lot of work with clients, but I knew that that wasn't for me. And it was, I left that world when I had my daughter. And as I was coming back into the work world from mat leave, so I had my daughter, which really changed me because I found myself a mother. I was 31 at the time. And I had to be a role model and I couldn't play anymore. I had this little baby who I wanted to give a life to, but I also wanted her to see me as someone she was proud of. And I think as women, you know, we're in such transformation, and, you know, I wanted her to know she had all the options in the world. And so I was considering what I wanted to do when I got a call from somebody who had volunteered for me back when I was in the charity world. And this individual had volunteered on one of my gala committees, and he was in the advertising agency world. Now, one of the things that had happened in between leaving not-for-profit and this point was I had gone back to doing continuing ed and had done a certificate in advertising. This particular person didn't know that, but I got a call kind of out of the blue from this individual. And we had worked together in the agency or in the not-for-profit world, but I ran into him again when I was in the service industry, when I was in the call center world, because one of the clients that he represented in the agency world, advertising, was my client in this call center. And so we would run into each other from time to time. Anyway, he called me as I was on mat leave and said, "Hey, have you ever considered working in advertising?" And I was like, "Oh, geez, I would love that, but, you know, hard to get into, very difficult to break into." And he said, "Well, I think you'd be great. I've got a job." He was the head of a very large agency at the time, and come in and talk to me. And so in I went, and we had this conversation, and he offered me a job at double the rate that I had been making in the call center world. And as an account supervisor, which I didn't even know what it was, but it seemed too good to be true, quite frankly. I was like, "What? You're going to pay me what to do what?" And, you know, he was excited to have me join this team. And this was where it sort of started to all come together. You know, you say, like, every step I took me to the next step. And when I came into advertising, that became really clear for me. I didn't know what I knew. And here I come in as basically a manager working on accounts in direct marketing. At the time, this was a direct marketing advertising agency. And all of the IT work, computer work, writing specs for computer programs, understanding how to do direct mail, which we thought was all about doing giving campaigns, working on donor bases, which I learned were called databases. All of that suddenly became what this agency needed of me and what no one else in the agency world knew. I was a unicorn. I was this kind of odd person, had never worked in advertising, had studied marketing, but had never really used it in the way that I was now being asked to use it. I was head and shoulders above everybody around me, but had no idea. And within that first year of being in advertising, I was promoted 3 times. My salary more than doubled in that 1 year period. Why? Because everything I had done before was being used. I found myself in the exact right place at the exact right time. And I was valued and excited and winning awards and doing work that I only dreamed I could do. It was exciting.
This is beautiful, but here I want you to take a step back. You had a young daughter who was growing up, and you were very clear you needed to be the best mom. And there are a lot of us women who have this huge challenge of our career clocks and our biological clocks. And when we are climbing up the career ladder, it's our children who ask for maximum attention. There are many of us who give up in the fight and take the parental role, though not everyone's happy with that choice. But you managed to balance it all. So what would you want to tell women at this point? Because it's important for women later not to regret and work wisely when they have the choice in front of them. So what would you want to tell?
You know, I don't know that I balanced it. I think I I really tried to be the best mother I could. The thing I knew about myself was that I could never be a stay-at-home mom. I knew that. I knew that, and not because I couldn't afford it or couldn't, it was not for me. And I knew that I wouldn't be a good mother as a stay-at-home mom, that my daughter would suffer for it because I would suffer. And so, but I also knew that I wanted to be a good mother. And so for me, I made the choices of continuing to work in a very demanding industry and job, but keep my daughter with me as much as I could. And so, you know, I had, I found places for her, childcare places for her, where she was loved like a mother would love her. So I never put her into daycare in the traditional what we have here, where it's sort of large groupings. I always put her in people's homes. I would find moms who were taking in children, and they would become almost surrogate moms for my child during the day. And so she had that loving environment that would never have been me. But when we were together, you know, and we became sort of a little team. My weekends were spent with my daughter, and she loved, you know, she loved to be in activities. She was in dance all of her childhood. And so I loved being a dance mom, and we would go to, you know, I would pick her up from her babysitter, and every, you know, in the evening, she would go to dance 3 nights a week and on the weekends. And so I was with her, I would take her to all her competitions. And, you know, and we just did things together. We always had plans. And so, and, you know, and she would come to work with me sometimes if she was sick. You know, I had a type of job where it wasn't easy for me to be able to not show up. And so, you know, I look back now and I think, oh God, Mother of the Year, you know, there's my sick child literally sleeping under my desk. Like, not a proud moment. But, you know, in some ways it is, though, because we had a relationship where that was okay. And she understood, and she was proud of me in those days. She used to love to come to work with me, and we would bring, she was always a creative child. And so we would bring lots of crayons and paper and, you know, things for her to create all day long. And so she would entertain herself, and I would, you know, be in meetings, and she would be sort of with me down at my feet or off in a corner or sitting at a table creating, and I would be there working. And, you know, What I would say to others is that you have to find your own path. There is no one way. If you want to be that mother who stays home with your children and does that, that is an important job. You should do that. And you should be proud of that. That is important. And it was important for me that those moms were out there, because they helped me. You know, it takes a village, right? And so I was so incredibly grateful for the moms who made the decisions that they wanted to stay home and take other people's children. But that's a choice. You know, if you want to be like me and be a career woman, then do that too. And do it in a way that you can be proud of the woman you are, the mother you are, and the role model you are, because that's what you are. We're all role models for our children, both male children and female children. And we're creating new ways for them to see the world. So show up in who you are as the best you can be for that. We don't do it 100% of the time. I made tons of mistakes. There are lots of things I look back and think I probably should have done that differently. But what I know is that it shaped the woman my daughter is today, and it shaped the woman I am today.
I think the problem with us women is we want to be perfect in everything, and perfection is a myth. So it's okay not to be okay. It's okay to acknowledge your flaws and move ahead. I think it keeps us a lot more grounded and easy in a lot of moments of life where we feel we're letting down everyone around us. So Andrea, you are today a TED speaker coach. And when it comes to TED Talks, it's everyone's dream to be a TED speaker or a TEDx speaker. So if there are three things that people should remember, I know you coach people on it, but three things that people should remember, even if they're aspiring to be TED speakers, what would be those three things that every man or woman should remember when they are dreaming that dream?
So the first thing is we're all storytellers. Humans innately love stories, and our lives are nothing more than one long, unending story. And we forget that. We think that that our lives are, you know, sort of the things that we do and the way that we live. But if you think about it, I mean, I've just told you some of the stories of my life, and, you know, I could continue on, you know, for hours with stories of my life. Why? Because I've lived a long life, and I've got many more years to go. But we live a life of stories. But here's the thing. Our stories, even though the details are different, as humans, we all live the same life. We all are born. We all have parents. We may have siblings. We have a childhood. We have some form of education. We go into some form of work or some form of a, you know, a marriage, you know, having children or not children. But these are all common across the human experience. And so when I tell you my story, what I'm doing is I'm helping you to live your story. And so you're living your story inside of mine. And what we're doing is we're creating deep and meaningful connections in doing that. And so know that your life is a story and that it's important. It's important for you and it's important for the people who hear it because it helps them to understand and contextualize their own lives. So that's number one. Number two, have an idea. So we all have lots and lots of ideas. And when people say to me, oh, I want to give a TED talk. And what they'll do is they'll come to me and they'll tell me a story, which is great. Stories are important. They're a big part of being a TED talk, but that's not a TED talk. A TED talk is ideas worth sharing. So what's the idea that lives inside of that story? And there are lots of ideas that can live inside of stories. And so when you have this story that you believe needs to be told on a TED stage, take a moment, take a step back and isolate what's inside of that story that's making you want to tell it on a TED stage, because that's the idea worth sharing. And take that idea and articulate it outside of that story. And when you can isolate it and articulate it, then go back and build that story so it leads to that idea. That's incredibly important. And then the final thing about giving a TED talk is that when you're on a TED stage, you are playing the role of a thought leader. In fact, you are a thought leader. And so thought leadership is important and it's a responsibility. And so many people don't think of themselves as a thought leader because, you know, we live in a world where thought leaders are elevated into heads of state or heads of industry or heads of companies. And the reality is we need more thought leaders who live lives like you and I, because we do have thought leadership. And that's what TED has given as a platform. It has elevated the everyday person to the level of thought leader. Now, there are many people who are heads of industries and state that speak on the TED stage, but there are many, many more that are like you and I. But what those people have done that are on that TED stage is they have elevated themselves into that role of thought leader. So if you want to get on a TED stage, recognize you are a thought leader. So when you recognize you're a thought leader and you isolate your idea and you articulate it as an idea and you wrap that idea in your life story, you will be very attractive to TED organizers to get on that TED stage.
Honestly, this is really, really useful, I'm sure, for anyone who's aspiring to be a TED speaker or TEDx speaker. And many of us love to reflect on our lives and our stories. But the pandemic forced all of us to reflect. Many people were running the rat race and were so lost in it. And suddenly there came a pause button when we least expected it. All of us have our reflections. What have been yours, Andrea, the last 2 years?
I've had a lot of reflections in the last 2 years. And, you know, as we're coming out of it, it's starting to become a little bit more conscious. I think one of the things that for me has become very clear out of the pandemic is that the need to slow down, the need to go within, the need to focus. In the early days of the pandemic, our business was very affected because, you know, we work with speakers and of course everything was shut down. And I found myself in this place of wondering, what do I do? You know, how do I maintain my business? How do I maintain what it is I do, what I love to do? And I was quite frankly bereft because I love the work I do. And suddenly I wasn't able to do it because there was no one doing it. And I started a web series called Sense Making Conversations. And what I was doing was interviewing speakers, people who I knew, thought leaders, on their views on the future. And what that did for me is it allowed me to see myself in this role of a thought leader. I had never seen myself as a thought leader. And I really fought it. I was like, no. I work with thought leaders. I help others become thought leaders. I'm not a thought leader. And yet, as I did more and more of my sense-making conversations, I started to understand that because of the work I do, I am a thought leader. And that I had to start embodying the very principles that I was teaching. And I had to step out from behind the stage to the front of the stage. And I had to start doing that more. And I had to start speaking. And that was really hard for me. I've always been the one behind everybody else. And I had to go out front. So the reflection for me coming out of the pandemic is that don't be afraid to own who you are. Use your voice. Your voice is powerful and important. And we learn from each other. And so when you tell your story, when you're able to share your ideas, when you do what it is that you do for love and for passion, we all feel it, we learn from it, and from that place, each of us grows. So that, and then the other thing I would say I learned coming out of the pandemic is that creativity is incredibly important, and it is a practice that needs to be practiced daily. That creative soul, that little Andrea who was, using discarded wire to create jewelry, really wanted to create again. And all through the pandemic, I have rediscovered this creative soul inside of me that I kept hidden for so long. And I've become a maker, and, you know, through yarn craft, through jewelry making, through painting, through candle making, suddenly I have explored all of these making activities that I don't think I ever knew I wanted to do. But now they're a big part of my life.
So you kind of spend time now making jewelry as well?
I do. Jewelry is something I've continued to make all through my life. I've gone into jewelry making phases for various things. And so I still do. And I still have lots of things to make. But right now, my biggest love is I have learned and taught myself how to crochet. And that is what I do. A lot of hours a day when I'm not working, I'm crocheting. And it's meditative. And I think that's what I need in this moment. And all creative activities in some way have a meditative element to them. And it's that ability to kind of keep my hands busy so my brain can wander and be in other places. And that's been very important for me.
And three life lessons as we come to the conclusion of this conversation.
So three life lessons. One, stay curious. You know, it is the thing I think that I credit with all of my success. I have always been that curious, headstrong young girl who wanted to know everything about everything. And I kept asking why. And asking why has gotten me into lots of trouble, but also into many, many new places I never would have gone. I've learned so much. The asking why, the keeping the open mind, the curious always brings something unexpected. So stay curious because it keeps us young and it keeps us, it gives us the ability to always learn. So be curious. The second life lesson is we never get it done. Life is a journey and it's not a destination. There is no destination. We never get it done. And, you know, there's one of the gurus that I follow always says you can never get it wrong because you never get it done. And so it's such an important message, right? Because we think, oh my God, I failed. I didn't get the job, or I got fired from the job, or, you know, the marriage broke up, or, you know, that project didn't work out. I failed. It's not a failure. That's just a it truly is. It's a learning opportunity. You don't know why that's happening to you. And this is where curiosity plays into the journey. Because if you can be curious inside of what is perceived as a failure, what you find are two things. One, the gift, that's why that came to you. And two, the path to the next place. And so know that life is a journey. And you can never get it wrong because you never get it done. And then the third thing I would say is really embody all of who you are. I'm 56 and I have purple and pink and blue hair right now. My hair has been many colors most of my life. This is not new. I started doing this, I think, when I was in my 30s. And no one was doing colored hair in those days. And why do I do it? I do it because it is who I am. It is the expression of me. And I'm not afraid to express who I am. I show up in all of myself. And it gets me in trouble sometimes. And other times I'm not welcome. And sometimes I'm really welcomed because what I do is I make it okay for others to show up in all of who they are. Because I show up that way. And we each are unique. And so when we show up fully embodying who we are, we can allow for an environment of love and an environment of creativity and differences to live together without, you know, judgment. And I think that's a really important space to create for people. So be all of who you are and be unapologetic about it. It'll get you in doors that you never thought would open, and there'll be doors that'll close behind you that you wanted, but you learn you didn't need.
Ooh, wow. That is really, really true, powerful, and what a wonderful way to end the conversation. Because I think when you wholly accept yourself as to who you are, the world has no choice but to accept you as well. And thank you so much, Andrea, for being the inspirational person that you are and the magic that you spread, first with the videos that you share on LinkedIn that I'm a huge diehard fan of, and each one of them and the way you connect your messages to those videos, continue that magic. It's amazing to see those videos, brings a smile on. And in whatever you do to help other people find what the thought leadership quality is there in them, the idea in them that needs a seed, a germination that the world needs to actually admire and listen to. Fantastic. Thank you so much for being on You and I with Rashmi Shetty. A pleasure talking to you. And God bless you, Andrea, for all that you're doing.
Well, thank you so much, Rashmi. I so appreciate you and the work you're doing in the world. And I am so excited to see what's next for you. So thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we come to the end of this weekly quest of You and I with Rashmi Shetty. Do let us know if you know people who make the world beautiful. Write in to rashmi.thethirdeye@gmail.com. That is rashmi.thethirdeye@gmail.com. Come, let's explore this amazing world together, both you and I.